ऐश्वरस्य समग्रस्य वीर्यस्य यशसः श्रियः ज्ञानवैराग्ययोश्चैव षण्णा भगतिङ्गना. All of these divine qualities taken together constitute the nature of Bhagavan, personal God. Majesty, valor, fortune, fame, knowledge, and renunciation. Good morning, everyone. This morning we'll finish a topic that we began last Sunday, which is based almost entirely on this one verse from the Vishnu Purana, giving all of the characteristics of Bhagavan. Bhagavan, I will see the personal God in both aspects of cosmic aspect and divine incarnation, avatar. So I want to start with just a little summary of what we went through last week. Last week was really the introduction to the whole thing. And then we'll get to the heart of the matter this morning. But I want to give a very short introduction summarizing what we went through last time. This talk was based on an article that I read that was written by Swami Amayanandaji, who was for many years the head of our center in Jayanambati. Many of you know him, very loving Swami. He has recently been transferred to Dhaka. He's now the head of the Dhaka center. He wrote this article on Sri Ramakrishna, quoting this verse, taking these six attributes. Bhagavan, Bhaga refers to these qualities. Van means possessed of. So Bhagavan means someone who is possessed of these six virtues. He took all six of them and tried to show how they especially apply to Sri Ramakrishna. So I thought it was a very nice idea, very charming, and I wanted to expand on that idea. So this is the history of this topic that we began last week. So this basic concept of Bhagavan, this is where we started, that from the cosmic point of view, we can say it's the personal God. However we understand that personal God, Brahman with qualities, with attributes, who also dwells within as the antaryamin, the inner controller, all of these aspects. So the source of creation, entering into everything and upholding everything and withdrawing everything, all the cosmic functions, all of this is Bhagavan, who is non-different from Ishvara or Brahman or Paramatman. They're all different terms used for that same basic reality, right? Which is seen in different contexts and which emphasizes different functions or no functions. If it's Brahman, the infinite absolute, transcending everything, then we use the term Nirguna Brahman. But that same Brahman is responsible for everything. And that same Brahman is worshipped as the personal God, and that same Brahman manifests as each and every human being and as everything in this whole universe, but in a special way as the avatar. So this is that concept of the Brahman, say of the Bhagavan, the Brahman with that creative aspect, so also known as Ishvara, also known as Divine Mother, also known as the Shiva and Narayan, all different forms that God is worshipped that way, in a personal form, is this Bhagavan. Now, why do we have these different concepts of God, Brahman and Paramatman and Bhagavan? Because people have different temperaments and like to approach God in a different way. And this Brahman is, it's one we know and homogenous, but also multifaceted. We can see it from different angles and in different ways, but the basic idea is that there are people who follow specifically Jnana Yoga, and their main interest is this Nirguna Brahman. Now, those who are interested in Raja Yoga, meditation, turning within, they're not so concerned about this whole universe. At that time of meditation, we forget the universe, all the cosmic functions and everything. We want to see that divine reality dwelling within our hearts, the Paramatman, that Supreme Self. So this Paramatman will be for those following Raja Yoga, and for the devotee following the path of Bhakti Yoga, And they want God as a person, that personal aspect of God. So each of these different aspects of God or of Brahman are of special relevance and value to people following a particular spiritual path based on their own particular temperament. Now, when we look at the personal God, we see there are all different types of qualities that we can attribute to that personal God. Whether it's us attributing it or whether they really belong there, this is a different question, how subjective it is and how objective it is. But in general, we see that there are two different types of attributes. One is called Aishwarya. These are lordly, kingly types of things that we like to think of as, you know, God, this cosmic figure of God. And the other are Madhurya. These are very sweet aspects. This can also be part of the personal aspect of God as the cosmic God, if we like to think of the Divine Mother, loving and sweet and everything. But it can also be the attributes of the Divine Incarnation in a particular form, say the child Krishna. Now, the Divine Incarnation in a different form, Rama, we may see more of these Aishwarya, because he had that strength and valor and everything. When we get to Sri Ramakrishna, we'll find that the Aishwarya, this lordly, strong, courageous, bold aspect, is a little beneath the surface, and that sweet aspect is more manifest in everything. Now, the six bhagas, the six characteristics of the personal God that we have here, belong mostly to this Aishwarya aspect, that lordly aspect. And we'll find when we go through all of these that from a very superficial point of view, we can say Thakur didn't have any of them. They don't seem to apply to him. But from a deeper point of view, if we mix in that madhurya, that sweetness aspect, we see that he manifested all of them in a very important and essential way. So this is kind of the task that we have today. We'll be examining all of these characteristics of Bhagavan, which normally we think of as Aishwarya, as these lordly ones, in the context of the life of Sri Ramakrishna, and we'll see how he did manifest them all, but in his own very sweet and loving and charming Madhurya, sweet way, so that the Aishwarya and Madhurya, the very lordly, rajasic almost aspect, and the very sweet, loving, sattvic aspect, get merged and combined in a very charming way. This is a part of the charm of the personality of Sri Ramakrishna. So the key to all of this, we'll see, is this uniqueness of the personality of Sri Ramakrishna and the hiddenness of these virtues. It's not that these lordly things don't exist, but he himself kept them hidden. He kept them under the surface. And because of that, so many people were fooled by him. So many people failed to see his greatness. He was thought of to be a little bit eccentric, a little bit mad. Some thought that he was maybe a great holy man. Others weren't so sure. Very few realized the extent to his greatness, let alone his divinity, during his lifetime. Now, this is true to a certain extent with all avatars. And Sri Ramakrishna makes a big point about this, that when the Lord takes a human body, he takes on many of the imperfections of the human body, because it's only through Maya that he can be born this way. So he used to quote this little couplet. It says, Pancha Bhute Fande Brahma Pare Kande, that Brahman, caught in the snare of the five elements, weeps. Now, the five elements caught in the snare, that means as soon as a Brahman takes a body, then he's subject to all of the emotions that everyone else is. So Thakur says this is why Rama wept for Sita when she was kidnapped. So that a little of that Maya comes over, and this humanness is there. Of course, it's a different type of Maya than we have. It's just a thin veil, and it's all a play and everything, but still we see that. And this was especially the case in the life of Sri Ramakrishna. He was so human in so many ways, and he himself gives the explanation. He said, this time the Lord has come, referring to his own birth. This time the Lord has come with the glory, Aishwarya. So that lordly aspect, the glory, with the glory of the sattva guna. So that means it'll manifest in its own special way. Like a king disguised as a beggar, visiting the various places in his kingdom. Now, what the king does is he takes off his beautiful robes and everything and wears the dress of a peasant so the people won't recognize him, but he's still the king. And he still has all of the virtues and the high-mindedness and nobility and everything. The king, but it remains hidden. So this disguise in the case of Sri Ramakrishna was so perfect that very often people fail to see it completely. And it seems like these virtues were actually absent in his life in many cases. So we'll find out that, see that the defining feature in Sri Ramakrishna's life with regard to many of these qualities was their absence, not their presence. From this external point of view, of course, we'll have to examine it to see how they manifested in his own special way. So let's go back to this verse that everything is based on, and we'll see these six different bhagas, six different attributes. The first one, Aishwarya. Now, don't get confused. I've been talking about Aishwarya and Madhurya. This is the first of these six, but all six of them fall within this one category. So all six of them are actually these lordly types of qualities, but in particular, this Aishwarya means lordliness, majesty, or glory. Then we have Virya. Virya means heroism, courage, strength, virility, manliness. Then Yashas, fame or recognition, renown. Then Shri is a little hard to pin down. It can mean wealth, fortune, prosperity. It can also mean auspiciousness, beauty. Almost any positive attribute can be Shri. Then Jnana and Vairagya. We have knowledge or wisdom, and Vairagya, renunciation, dispassion, and detachment. All right, let's start with Aishwarya. Of course, this term comes from Ishwara. Ishwara, so Aishwarya means any quality really that belongs to Ishwara. Ishwara is nothing but this Saguna Brahman with the particular function of creation. And with this idea of controlling, this idea of power, ruling. So even the term Ishwara, sometimes it's used not referring to God. Just as in English, Lord can be used to refer to God, or it can be a Lord of the Manor, someone who is a very powerful person. So Ishwara can also be like that. So it's Ishwara is that Brahman in connection with Chit Shakti, that power to project the universe, and then that power to enter into the universe and sustain the universe, and that power to withdraw. So the three cosmic functions all refer to this Ishwara. And then at the time of Pralaya, when there's no universe at all, Ishwara remains as Brahman. That's the snake that's not moving anymore, remains coiled up. So it's this defining feature of the majestic aspect of Brahman that will include all of the others, this Aishwarya, and an individual. Now, if we think of the how it manifests, not as from the cosmic function, but in terms of the avatar, divine incarnation, it'll be seen as royalty and pomp, splendor, lordliness, probably, if we think of Rama, the incarnation of Rama, we get that a little bit of that sense. Sometimes it will indicate the possession of great strength and power, or even riches and property. We can say, if we want to have a nice image for ourselves, and Thakur uses that image, the peacock with the tail spread out, with a beautiful arrangement of all the feathers and everything, peacock feathers. So it has a large dose of rajas in it. Part of the essential aspect of this Aishwarya is a little bit of show, a little bit of pomp there. Now, when Sri Ramakrishna gave that made that statement when he said, this time the glory, the Lord has come with the glory of the Sattva Guna. He uses the term Aishwarya. So from the Rajasic point of view, he was completely free of all of that. There was not the slightest bit of show. He hated that word, dong, he used to say. There's no show here, he used to say. Everything was purposely done so that people wouldn't even recognize his greatness. You see, we're always trying to get recognition and everything. He was the exact opposite. There are so many nice stories. Once when he was a young priest at Dakshineshwar, plucking flowers for puja, he looked so simple and humble and everything. Some babu from Calcutta came and assumed that he was a gardener. And he said, oh, can you pick some flowers for me? I want to offer. So Thakur, he didn't say anything. Very happily, he picked some and gave it. It was only later that he found out that this was Sri Ramakrishna himself. So this is why this Rajasic element of Aishwarya was completely absent, and why he said that the sattvic aspect of Aishwarya, what did he say that meant? That was love, compassion, discrimination, renunciation, forgiveness, and so on. And these we know that Sri Ramakrishna had to the fullest possible measure. Now, does this mean that he didn't have this other aspect of Aishwarya at all? Was that completely absent? There were times when he would enter into a different type of mood. We know that he could be laughing and joking 1 minute with the young boys there, and the next minute he would be in that mood. He would go into that deep samadhi, and everyone would look on, awestruck, with great reverence, wondering who this great soul was sitting before them. So he would enter into that different realm, that kingdom of the self, and he would manifest a certain type of power that time that people understood and people saw, not knowing what was going on within. No one had any clue, but they could tell that his mind was soaring in some other realm. We have this one image of Sri Ramakrishna, which is one of my favorites. I mention it very often. M saw him this way during his second visit. He came back, it was twilight, and Sri Ramakrishna was standing in front of the Kali temple, in front of the Natmandir, walked pacing back and forth, just as the lion paces back and forth in the jungle, absorbed in the joy of the self. So this Pashuraj, this lord of beasts, king of the jungle, Thakur manifested that also. So if we want to look for that Aishwarya aspect, from this point of view, we have to say that he did possess it on occasion. But when he was in his normal frame of mind, he didn't like to do anything that involved any show or any pomp or anything like that. Now, there's a second meaning of Aishwarya, and that is the possession of yogic powers, the siddhis. This is also the glory of Ishvara, or of these realized souls. These eight ashta siddhis that we read about in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, Sri Ramakrishna mentions them very often. Anima, mahima, becoming very large, becoming very small, becoming heavy, becoming weightless, all sorts of different things, miraculous things to us. According to the science of yoga, these come through some control of the mind and everything. Now, in Sri Ramakrishna's case, he spoke about these very often in the most negative terms. He used to say that, you can get these through the practice of yoga, but if anyone possesses even one of the eight siddhis, miraculous powers, he won't realize God. That the mind will get attached to it, it'll keep the mind down to a lower plane, he may be able to do wonderful things, but that person won't be able to realize God. So Sri Ramakrishna had no interest in these things. Swami Vivekananda even less. We know that he couldn't stand his anything that smacked of miracles and superstition, and he said weakening of the mind. Now, it doesn't mean they didn't believe in them, and it doesn't mean that Thakur didn't have them. There's a very interesting letter that Swamiji wrote to his Madrasi disciple Kitty. As to the wonderful stories published about Sri Ramakrishna, wonderful stories means of all these miraculous things. I advise you to keep clear of them and the fools who write them. And this is very important. He says they are true. So he's not denying it. They are true, but the fools will make a mess of the whole thing, I am sure. He had a whole world of knowledge to teach. Why insist upon unnecessary things, as miracles really are? They do not prove anything. Matter does not prove spirit. What connection is there between the existence of God, soul, and immortality, and the working of miracles? Preach, Sri Ramakrishna, pass the cup that has satisfied your thirst. Preach bhakti, do not disturb your head with metaphysical nonsense, and do not disturb others by your bigotry. Now, the point that I really want to make here is that Swamiji said these things are true. That meant that Thakur had these powers, and he used to say that he never sought them, but through his intent sadhana, these things came to him. In fact, he used to say that, he told Swamiji, then Narendra, that, look, I have these powers, they're no use to me. I can transfer them to you. And then Narendra said, well, will it help me realize God? He said, no, it won't help you realize God, but after God realization, it'll be very helpful in the work that you're meant to do. And he said, no, if it won't help with God realization, then let me wait and have that first, then we can see later. But at the very end, of Sri Ramakrishna's life, when he and Swamiji were together alone in the room at Kashipur, Sri Ramakrishna went into a very deep spiritual state. Swamiji also felt some electric charge go into him and lost outer consciousness, and remained that way for some time. And when he came out of that state, he saw Sri Ramakrishna weeping. And he said, today I am a penniless fakir, penniless beggar. Whatever I have, I have given to you. That meant he had transferred all of these powers to Swamiji. Now, do we see any instance of Sri Ramakrishna using these powers during his lifetime? There were times, because of Swamiji and his very clear understanding that people like these things more than the important things, we don't talk about them too much. But there's one in particular that we know about from the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. And this had to do with Durga Puja that was being celebrated in his devotee's home, in Surendra's home. Surendra had this great desire that Sri Ramakrishna come and bless that puja with his presence. But Sri Ramakrishna was then ill. He was in Shyampakur at that time. So it was impossible for him to go. But he said that he would go somehow with a subtle body. And later he said to Surendra, yesterday evening at 7 or 7:30, I saw your worship hall in a vision. I saw the divine image full of effulgence. This place and your hall were joined by a stream of light flowing between them. And he even gave some details and everything. Surendra said, yes, just at that time, you're right, I was sitting there and weeping and this and that. So we know it happened, we don't know how it happened, whether it's one of the siddhis, whether the subtle body traveled, whether it was vision, we don't know, but we know that Sri Ramakrishna did have this ability, but kept it hidden again, and certainly didn't emphasize these things. So this is Aishwarya. Then, second one is Virya. This means strength. Virya, strength and valor and courage, manliness. All of the things that Sri Ramakrishna seemed to lack. Right? He wasn't big and strong. He didn't have that tremendous courage. We have that one incident. I don't remember all the details, but he was in danger somehow. So what does he do? He started repeating all the different names of God that he could think of so he would be protected. If one doesn't work, maybe the other would work. So physically, he didn't have that type of strength. He used to say that Chaitanya Dev, he went from house to house spreading the name of the Lord. I can hardly walk from one place to another. And it's true, towards the end of his life, he had to be carried by palanquin if he went any distance at all. And so from this external physical point of view, he didn't exhibit any of that strength, physical strength or anything. There were times, of course, in that state of ecstasy when he would have the strength of a lion again and sing and dance for hours and people could hardly keep up with him. But in general, his constitution was weak. His health wasn't good. He suffered from stomach problems his whole life. So he really didn't strike anyone as very bold or daring during his lifetime. These are the last things we would use to describe him. But if we look at this idea of courage and boldness from a deeper aspect, we see that during his period of sadhana, he exhibited the greatest fearlessness. Why do I say greatest fearlessness? Because his very life was in danger. His sanity was in danger. The health, forget about his health. He knew that, I mean, he went through a period of 6 years where he barely slept and he hardly ate at all. And he was acutely aware that he was embarking on a journey that no one knew where it would lead him. That he easily could have lost his life or very easily could have gone mad. And still, he wouldn't give it up. So from this point of view, we can say he manifested the greatest virya. Not the virya that Rama had in going in search of Sita and fighting Ravana and all of that, but this deeper, more important type of courage and fearlessness with regard to his search for God realization. So that's number two. Then number three, third bhaga, is yasas, fame, recognition, renown. Now, how famous was Sri Ramakrishna? Towards the end of his life, one day he was sitting around with some of his inner circle, the devotees, very close disciples and devotees, and just for fun, they were counting the number of disciples or very close devotees that really formed the inner circle. They came up with 30, something like that, during his lifetime, so almost nothing. Nowadays, anyone declares that they're an avatar, they'll get thousands of people to follow them. But he not only didn't care, but he didn't want to be known. He didn't like it. He said that three words pricked his flesh. He used to say there's some type of horned fish, poisonous fish, that can sting you or something, and like blowfish or something. He said, if he's addressed like that, he felt as if he were stung that way. Guru, Karta, and Baba. So he couldn't bear to have anyone refer to him as a guru. He said, I'm no one's guru. He said, I'm the dust of the dust of your feet. I'm the servant of your servant, he used to say. And this Karta, master. Karta, again, the Aishwarya master, of the spiritual master or whatever. And Baba, his father, but a holy man. He couldn't bear to be referred to in any of these terms. When the Brahmani, Bhairavi Brahmani, convened a meeting of all the great pundits to decide whether Sri Ramakrishna was simply a madman, or whether he was a great soul, or whether he was an avatar, Sri Ramakrishna just sat completely indifferent. Some of them said, yes, he has all the signs of a divine incarnation, an avatar. Now, most people would think they would get puffed up with pride and everything. And he would just sit there and say, oh, you say that, he said that. His was even better than yours. And completely indifferent to that. So he had no interest whatsoever in being declared an avatar. He didn't care if people, we saw before, thought of that he was the gardener. He didn't care if people thought he was a cheat, even. We have that story, incident. Sri Ramakrishna was at Mathura Babu's house. And the family priest, who was really a priest of the Kalighat temple, happened to be there when Sri Ramakrishna was there and no one else was there. And this priest hated Sri Ramakrishna because he thought he was a hypocrite and a cheat and a fake and was feigning ecstasy and everything so that he would get in the good graces of Mathura Babu. So he's very jealous of him. And Sri Ramakrishna was in an ecstatic mood, had no consciousness of the external world, and this Chandra, I think was his name, took that opportunity to to actually kick him lying on the ground. Now, Sri Ramakrishna was aware enough to know what was going on, but he never even told anyone. It happened to come out much later. And Mathura Babu said, Father, if you had told me, I would have had him killed. That's how much reverence and power this Mathura Babu had, but he didn't pay any attention. He didn't care about praise or blame. So this yashas, this fame, was something that he was completely indifferent to. It was really because of Keshav Sen and the members of the Brahmo Samaj that his name became known in Calcutta. Keshav used to speak about him from the pulpit, and then there were several articles written about him. They used to write about him in their periodical. Even then, sometimes Sri Ramakrishna would say, Keshav, why do you write these things about me? So he didn't care. He preferred to remain hidden that way. Now, on the other hand, from his very childhood, there were people from his own village who recognized him. Many knew the story of his mother's vision at the Shiva temple and his father's vision in Gaya. So they knew that story that some special divine child had been born. And one of the villagers, Chinu Shankari, he was probably the first to recognize Sri Ramakrishna as an avatar. That was his conviction, and worshipped him that way in his courtyard. If you go to Kumarpukur, has anyone seen it? They'll take you to that place sometimes. It's still there. So there were those, of course, who recognized him. And to his very intimate disciples, he revealed himself, not because he wanted name and fame, but because he wanted them to know that he felt that it was important for their faith and devotion. So he would reveal himself in that way. But in general, he really preferred to be the king in disguise and to not let others see. To the general public, he was very happy to have them think that he was nobody. So that's yashas, fame. Then fourth is Shri. As I said before, this is a little hard to pin down, but one of the meanings is wealth, fortune, prosperity. Shri is the name of Lakshmi, the goddess of wealth. Now, how do we connect wealth and fortune and prosperity with Sri Ramakrishna when he couldn't even bear the touch of money? Right? Where gold to him was the worst possible thing. Gold was a symbol of greed. Where he could barely touch even metal, ordinary metal. There was a time in his life when he couldn't even take food off a metal plate or anything. He had to ask M to buy some plates and bowls made out of stone for his use. So this was the nature of Sri Ramakrishna. He couldn't bear to possess anything, any property. There were some very wealthy devotees who wanted to give a big estate or property or put money in the bank for Sri Ramakrishna for his future use. He would get furious. He said, no, you're trying to kill me. What are you trying to do? And then they said, well, we'll put in the name of your wife or something. No. So he couldn't bear that. He couldn't bear to save anything, even for the very next day, even the simple little things. If he took something and forgot, put it in his pocket, then he would find himself wandering about to go into the Ganges and drown himself till he realized, oh, yes, I took something that's meant for tomorrow, so he would get rid of it. So from this point of view of wealth, fortune, prosperity, he had nothing to do with that. So the Shri is completely irrelevant from that point of view. Then this idea of beauty and auspiciousness, when we think of the personal appearance of Sri Ramakrishna, of course, we see him when he was older, tooth is chipped, he has a beard and everything. When he was young, we hear that he was quite a striking figure. Holy Mother said that his complexion was so golden that he had a little golden, an amulet with a little golden kalacha on that he would wear, that you couldn't see it. The color of the gold would mix with the color of his skin, so you could barely see it. There was once a time when someone with a very fair complexion came to Dakshineshwar, and Sri Ramakrishna wanted Holy Mother to judge which one is fair, him or me. So So he was probably very enchanting physically even when he was younger. There's an interesting story. Once Sri Ramakrishna was in Kamarpukur and his nephew Hridoy was with him. I don't remember all of the details. This may have been when they were going for the kirtan every day. But on that particular day, Sri Ramakrishna came out of his room, and whenever he went anywhere, all the village people would come just to see him. They just wanted to see him. And that day, everyone was staring at him. And Thakur said, Hridoy, why is everyone staring at me? And Hridoy said, Uncle, see, you've been chewing pan, so your lips are stained red. And you're wearing this beautiful cloth with the silk and red border and everything. And they're astounded seeing your beauty. Now, what was Thakur's reaction? What would we say? Oh, really? That's nice. Thakur was so upset. He said, what? They're not seeing anything inner, just they're obsessed with his outer beauty? I won't go. And he went back to his room and he didn't go there. He was so upset. So with regard even to this physical beauty, he didn't want anything that would externally show this whatever he had within himself. He always wanted to remain hidden that way. With regard to the real Shri, with the real, what were the ornaments of Thakur? What was it that embellished him? Holy Mother probably understood better than anyone else. There was a conversation one day that took place in Holy Mother's presence, where some of the devotees were trying to decide what Thakur's main message was. And several of them said, Yatoma Totopat, as many faiths, so many paths. Then Holy Mother said, you know, it never occurred to me that he was born for that purpose. My understanding of that is that he was born to teach renunciation, that renunciation was his glory, renunciation was his adornment, alankar, that this was the main thing. So, in some sense, the absence of all of these ordinary elements of Shri represent the real quality of Shri in Thakur's life, that the virtues of renunciation, love of God, discrimination, detachment, compassion, these were his real ornaments. So this was number four. Now, fifth, knowledge. This is also very interesting. I had fun with this talk, by the way, thinking about all of these things. Yeah, what about Sri Ramakrishna's knowledge? What about his intelligence and his wisdom? He could add. Probably he could subtract a little bit. Multiplication and division, forget it. He couldn't do it. It was too complicated for him. Then, one time, Thakur asked M about the high tide and the low tide and everything. They were looking at Ganga, coming in and coming out. So M started to explain to him about the phases of the moon and how when the moon is closer to a full moon, that the tides are higher. And Thakur said, stop, my head is reeling, I can't understand any of this. Okay, so we're getting a picture of his intelligence now. Then, we hear that he was illiterate, right? Practically illiterate. When he was a boy, he learned how to write, and he had nice handwriting. We have some evidence of things that he wrote, but he never had any opportunity to write, so he really lost that skill. The last time we find him writing anything was when he was with Narendra towards the end of his life, and his throat cancer was so painful that he couldn't speak, really. So he tried to write, and he wrote, what was it, Joy Surya and Joy Radhe, something like that, and then Narendra will teach others. Now, if you read what he wrote, at least half a dozen spelling mistakes. And almost illegible, like a little child. So this was his knowledge of the Bengali language with regard to reading and writing. Now, scriptures. Did he ever refer to any of the Upanishads? Did Thakur ever quote any Sanskrit verses? Even Gita, only one or two little references. Right, how well did he know the scriptures, even? Of course, Bhagavata, Ramayana, Mahabharata, everyone knew. And he heard these things, and of course he remembered whatever he heard. But all of the type of scholarship that was praised by pundits, the great pundits who could recite Sanskrit verses all day long, he didn't care for any of that. Probably he knew Sanskrit. He had to know some. He was a priest. At least he had to memorize all of the Sanskrit verses and everything. And he used to say when the pundits discussed things in Sanskrit, he could understand. But did anyone ever hear pundits talking in Sanskrit? You would also understand. It's almost all Hindi or Bengali, all words that everyone knows. So it's not such a big thing. So with regard to all of these things, Thakur's knowledge, if we compare him to a scholar or a pundit, was nothing. But words of wisdom flowed from his lips day and night to such an extent that the greatest pundits of his day would sit for hours on end listening to him. This was the miracle of Thakur. This was a great miracle of him. He gave the clearest possible explanations of the most difficult Vedantic concepts in the simplest language with these beautiful illustrations based on village life. And it was just charming to everyone and so easy for them to grasp. Now, how was this possible? Thakur gave his own explanation. He used to say, Ma rash tali dichen. This is a reference to people who have to weigh paddy. You know, there's scales there, and there'll be a huge mound of paddy, and there'll be someone who's standing by the scale who's keeps putting on a certain amount so that they know the weight of that. And then as soon as he's finished and takes it off, someone will push some more to him so he can put more in the scale. So he'll never run out. So this is Thakur's way of saying that the Divine Mother supplied everything. I didn't have to think about it. No sooner would I say something than she would supply some other pearls of wisdom. So this was Thakur's own explanation. But we can also look at least two other reasons for Thakur's very unsophisticated but unique wisdom. One was his mind. It didn't require any book learning. Of course, he heard the greatest pundits. He heard and absorbed everything. It's not that he wasn't aware of these things, but traditional book learning, the way ordinary pundits study, he didn't need any of that. But his mind was tremendously clear. It was such a sattvic mind. Tremendously clear and flexible so that he could synthesize things. He could harmonize things. He could cut through all of the unnecessary layers of things. He used to give the example of the ant that can take the sugar out of a mixture of sand and sugar. This was the nature of his mind. So his mind was so clear and sharp, even with regard to very common sense things. When we look at the relationship between Sri Ramakrishna and Holy Mother, it's a very wonderful thing. He, of course, trained her in all types of sadhana and everything, but he also explained to her the most common sense things. When to leave a room, when to close the door, when to get on the boat, how to adjust to time and place, all of the things that are necessary just in ordinary everyday life. So he had that type of intelligence as well. Now, the other explanation, how he could explain things so clearly, is that he didn't talk about anything that he hadn't directly experienced himself. And there's a world of difference between knowledge that is based on scripture, or that's based on logic, even, or based on our own understanding of things. We always have to think, is this thing compatible with that thing? Is there any contradiction between this idea and that idea? If it's something we've experienced ourselves, then it's impossible for there to be any contradiction. It's the difference between someone who's writing a novel, right, and someone who's writing his own memoirs. In a novel, we always have to make sure that there's no flaw in the plot, that there's some contradiction, that we have some person here, but it turned out that they died the day before. How could they really be there? Now, if we're remembering things, these things can't come up because they actually happen. They're real. So everything he talked about was real to him. It wasn't theoretical to him. So because of this ability to experience everything directly from the highest point of view, he could have absolute faith and conviction that what he was saying was perfectly true. And he was very practical. And this is why we can say that simply to apply jnana to him isn't enough. There's vijnana. There's an application, not simply seeing this absolute pure Brahman consciousness, but seeing it dwelling within, becoming everything, manifesting everywhere, seeing the divine in each and every human being. This was that theoretical knowledge that was his direct vision, that was part of what he used to call this vijnana. So this is how this practically illiterate, simple village priest could go on hour after hour with these pearls of wisdom coming from his lips, enchanting these great minds, these pundits and the brightest young minds of Calcutta, Western educated, Swamiji and all of the others, how he could just charm them that way. So this is the fifth of the six bhagas, jnana. Now, vairagya. Now let's be very objective here with regard to renunciation and Sri Ramakrishna. Sri Ramakrishna liked to wear red bordered cloth and varnished slippers, right? Sometimes socks. If it was too cold out for his feet, he would wear socks, and a barber would come to his room and trim his beard nicely and give him a haircut. He didn't have one bed in his room, he had two beds. Okay, this is a great renunciate, Sri Ramakrishna. Then, he was a bit of a foodie, right? He loved food. He had different types of dishes. Sometimes he would say he went through different periods where first thing in the morning he would say, oh, make this dish and make that dish and use those spices that make that noise that sounds like a pig is grunting and everything. So he loved the different types of food. Then how about his pleasure trips, outings? He loved it. Go to the Maidan for a picnic, have a picnic in the Pantivati. Then trips to the museum, Asiatic Museum. He used to have great fun with that. Then went to Fort Williams. And then the circus. This is all renouncing sadhu, going to the circus. And seeing some English lady riding with one foot on top of a horse. And he was thrilled with the whole thing. Then going to the theater. All renouncing sadhu, going to the theater where these women of questionable character are playing the parts there. The theater where upright, upstanding people wouldn't be caught dead there. Even Swamiji, when his young boy, Narendra, he used to say he wouldn't walk on the same side of the street where the theater was. He'd cross over to the other side. Here, Thakur is going several times and having the time of his life. Of course, they were spiritually themed things, but in any event, so far, this is the picture we have of Sri Ramakrishna and renunciation. Now, how about detachment? Who was more attached than Sri Ramakrishna? If he didn't see Narendra for a day, he would weep. Purna, right? He had such tremendous attachment. His nephew, Akshay, when he passed away, how he cried. So Sri Ramakrishna, from this external point of view, didn't even have that type of detachment. If we want to find an example of real vairagya, then who will we look for? Someone like Totapuri, right? Totapuri is so detached he won't wear a stitch of clothes. He'll sleep outside by a dhuni fire. He won't stay any place more than 3 days at a time, so he'll never be attached to anything. And on and on and on. So this is the picture we get of Sri Ramakrishna and renunciation from the point of view of society. Now, from the deeper point of view, there was never a greater man of renunciation than Sri Ramakrishna, right? He was the master of renunciation. Swamiji wrote Tagishwar, right? That means the Lord. Swamiji is called Yatiraja, the king of monks, of renunciates. But Sri Ramakrishna wasn't just the king, he was the Lord of renunciates. So for him, real renunciation was lust and gold. This was the beginning and the end of renunciation. It had nothing to do with taking fish or chewing pond or anything like that. It was the renunciation of lust and gold. And in his mind, these things had been completely wiped out. Every woman was a manifestation of the Divine Mother for him. So no question even of having to deal with this idea of lust, no question of having to deal with this idea of greed, because he couldn't bear to possess anything. He was so free from that idea. That's why he didn't have to manifest these things in the ordinary way, because he was perfectly free from these things. Then this attachment to Narendra and the others. It was an attachment in the ordinary sense. What was the attachment to? He saw God dwelling within them. It was attachment to God. He even said to Narendra, I love you because I see Narayana within you. The moment I don't see Narayana within you, I won't be able to look at your face. So it was because they were such pure-souled, divine children in his mind that he had that great sense of attachment to them. So this was the real renunciation of Sri Ramakrishna, based on being perfectly established in the self and being perfectly free from ego. Because of those two things, then this renunciation of pride and greed and ignorance, selfishness, smallness, these were natural things. It didn't involve any effort on his part. They couldn't cling to him. So he was perfectly free from all of these. So that was the sixth. So we see from all of this that in many respects, especially this rajasic, from this rajasic aspect, Sri Ramakrishna was perfectly lacking in all of these six bhagas, these six qualities of Bhagavan from this external point of view, especially this rajasic, lordly aspect, aishwarya aspect, but the sattvic aspect was the essence of Sri Ramakrishna. He had all of these virtues and many, many more in this most sattvic sense. So from this higher point of view, Sri Ramakrishna was the perfect embodiment of all the six virtues. And when we meditate on him, and this is the real point of all of this whole discussion, we should try to remember all of these things, all of these virtues, these qualities, these attributes, these incidents from his life that will sweeten our meditation. So when we meditate on him, when we offer reverence to Sri Ramakrishna, we should think of all these divine qualities that apply to him both from this human level as the avatara and this other cosmic level as Bhagavan. So we remember all of these and these wonderful qualities of Sri Ramakrishna, who came in secret this time like the king in disguise to examine his kingdom. And during his lifetime, so few recognized him, and now millions of people are worshipping him. So this is Sri Ramakrishna in his form as Bhagavan. Let's take a few minutes now for meditation. Tena mam pahi nityam.